Rebecca.
And I'm Krabeshni.
And welcome to Building with Builders.
Our podcast where we believe that building is fun.
Super fun.
So much fun.
Build Her Collective was created to help women with building and renovating. And we believe that with the right tools, everyone can build. For us, it's all about encouraging women to take back control of the building process and really achieve their dreams.
We are women in the building industry, and as developers, builders, and project managers, it's our passion to share everything we know with other women doing the same. And that's why we've created this podcast for you.
So if you love all things building,
you're into design,
keen on the numbers,
about to renovate,
thinking and dreaming of that forever home and what it would look like,
or even developing for profit,
then you've found your family.
Subscribe to our podcast and follow our journey over at buildhercollective.com.au.
Welcome. We have Lockie here from Angle, and he is one of the directors there. He's going to talk to us today about all things building, developing, and really how to take a plunge into getting your own business started and running as a developer. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Would you mind, because I know you've got quite a history in construction and building, would you mind giving us a bit of an overview about what Angle does first, and then we'll jump into kind of your background and how you got there?
Yeah, for sure. So Angle, we started in 2013. We're a developer focusing on high-end residential. We do a lot in particular in Burundara, eastern suburbs more generally. We had a little venture into South Yarra, Elwood, and we'd definitely sort of go back to those suburbs. But we've got quite a good following now in Burundara. And I'd say we're absolute specialists in high-end residential. We don't sort of try to go outside of those realms and get tempted into commercial, industrial, or retail, sort of, you know, any other asset classes. So that's our bread and butter, and it's been a really successful model for us today, and we're going to continue working with it.
Yeah, and beautiful projects, and I guess that's one of the skills. So any of you that are listening along, I really urge you to go check out. So you could check it out on Instagram, you could check it out on angle.com.au. These are great places to look for inspiration because you are picking emerging designers, which we'll get to, and you're doing a really fantastic job of putting some beautiful but also different and interesting developments on. They're not cookie cutter.
Yeah, I think it's probably like one thing that we've always prided ourselves on is, you know, picking the next big thing in terms of architects and designers and not just going with the big names already. Luckily for us to date, ones that we have picked have sort of gone on to achieve great things. And I think also just being brave, not taking a cookie cutter approach and following what the rest of the market's doing necessarily, even though it's been against some of our mentors' advice, has probably paid off for us over the years.
Yeah, and I think that thing of developing being a dirty word for a lot of people, it's like, oh, you're a developer, so you're doing cheap finishes and kind of rolling them out with no regard to quality or finish or longevity. You know, you're flying in the face of that and you're showing people how it can be done properly.
Yeah, I think it's unfortunate the industry somewhat, you know, a lot of rogue developers out there, I would say, or, you know, the ones that don't have the best intentions at heart or they're just in it for the money. But we genuinely want to create like amazing buildings. And I think there's a market out there that will pay for that. And I say this to some of our buyers, it's like, you know, would you rather spend $3 million on an apartment and it's a 7 out of 10, or would you rather spend, you know, $3.3 million on it and it's a 10 out of 10? Like, it doesn't take that much extra money to make it truly amazing.
Does take a lot of planning and it takes a lot of foresight and it takes a lot of time, but I think it also takes the passion to be making the industry better, and I think that's something that we certainly can look to you on as well. Maybe also it takes a lot of background in construction and knowledge about how things come together and how to plan properly. Do you want to run us through your background? So
yeah, for sure. I'd be lying if I said I knew that I wanted to be a property developer when I was young. It was something that sort of came a little bit later in life, but at school, my favorite subject by far was economics, which, you know, you start in year 9 or 10 at school. So that sort of led me into doing a commerce degree. And luckily enough, I got quite good grades when I finished year 12. So Melbourne Uni at the time was offering a commerce and property degree as a double. So I chose that. And it became sort of pretty evident pretty quickly that where I wanted to be was development. After probably a year, I worked that one out. I think, you know, I love finance, I love economics, and I sort of still, you know, read about them and whatever as a hobby now. But I think that development sort of combines those two things really well with lots of other facets of the property industry, you know, in particular how markets work and supply and demand and pricing and, you know, how to ascertain value, which is like a super, super important part of development. So it was a 5-year degree, but you had to do an extra year before they gave you a degree in the workplace. And I didn't want to make it 6. So I started applying for jobs from my second year. And luckily for me, in my second year, I applied at a company called Clough Property. And that's where I met one of my business partners, Keegan. Both of us actually applied for the same job and they couldn't split us. So they gave us both a job. You know, we became best mates over that time and talked about wanting to do residential developments together one day. Sort of didn't know how and when, thought we might be a bit older with grey hair and more cash and whatever else. But he went off to work for Mirvac. I went off and worked for Goodman Group, who was Macquarie Goodman at the time. I met them when Clough sold a big land parcel and I was just very impressed the way they sort of went about their business, and they're the largest real estate trust in Australia now, and one of the largest industrial players globally. So amazing company. And I think I was very fortunate. I snuck in 2007, just before the GFC hit, and there was 55 people when I started, and 6 months later there was 12. So what it meant for me was I sort of accelerated my learning there. I was thrown in the deep end pretty quickly on things that I probably really didn't know. I was definitely out of my depth, but I used to have 20 people I could ask in the office and I had, you know, one being my boss. So that accelerated my career and learning pretty quickly, which is amazing. Had 5 years there. And, you know, there's lots of frustrating things about corporate life, but there's also lots of amazing things that you learn, in particular, you know, the disciplines sort of required, a lot of sort of technical skills that I use, you know, in our business now. But we made a call sort of end of 2012 to start Angle. And that's exactly what we did. So needed a little bit of a push. I was on a, you know, good corporate salary with good bonuses and all the rest of it. So it was a bit of a leap of faith at the time, but, you know, I was 26 years old and thought, you know, if we don't do it now, when will we ever do it? And we're very fortunate. We'd met some people in our corporate careers that were willing to back us if we ever went out on our own. So that sort of gave us the confidence to start Angle.
Yeah, perfect. And I think that's really great to have that commercial background to be able to bring to it, have the learning behind you. And I think a lot of people think, and we were talking about this before, but a lot of people think that they can just go into property development and they can go, okay, I've seen a house, I've watched the block, here we go.
Yeah, it's funny. I think a lot of people's eyes light up and they see the, you know, the potential dollars and they think, oh, this looks pretty straightforward. And, you know, in Australia and in Melbourne, we've been in a rising market for 100 plus years, generally speaking. So, you know, you can get away with mistakes every now and again. But at the end of the day, like anything, it's a profession and it's a full-time job and it's very technical. And I think people don't realize how hard it is and how much risk is associated with it and how many sort of different elements there are to the job. So going into it thinking that it's going to be straightforward and easy can be dangerous. And it's one of those things, you know, if you had an analogy, if I wanted to become a car mechanic, it's not as I could just rock up to a workshop and start working on a car. Like you actually have to learn some of the skills first. So definitely not something to sort of jump into without being willing to sort of learn and make mistakes along the way.
Yeah. So I think there's a couple of things in that, though. Like firstly, the drawing of different but complementary degrees. So, you know, the economics background to be able to bring that to projects as well and understand really the market influences and to be able to then choose your suburbs. It's not like picking a horse and, you know, which one's going to win. It's like you've got to really narrow down your interest and where you're focusing to be able to build a market, understand where that's going and who's moving in and out of that suburb. So I think that's great, but then learning with great mentors.
Yeah. And I think that most important skill in development, there's lots. It's like it's jack of all trades, master of none. You need to be like quite good at lots of things, but you're never going to be an expert in any one thing. But I think one of the most important things is being able to ascertain value. And that's, you know, the acquisition phase, you know, buying a block of land and then what you think you can sell something for. And if you can't work out those two things, then you're in a spot of bother. So by no means do I think you need to go and do a evaluation degree or property degree to sort of understand that. But I think your point about picking a suburb or, you know, a few suburbs and becoming experts in those suburbs is a really good piece of advice. You know, I always say to people, you know, Richmond is a good example. If you looked at Richmond, there's effectively, in my opinion, there's a half a dozen suburbs within Richmond. You can be in Richmond Hill, you can be sort of Cremorne Precinct, you can be in sort of Burnley Precinct, you can be up around Victoria Street, which is, they're all very different, and land rates might be anywhere from 2,500, 3,000 a metre up to in excess of 10,000 a metre. But if you're not an expert and you don't understand the nuances of that market and street to street and the precincts within it, then it's very easy to get caught out. And I think it'd be like if we went to Sydney and wanted to be a developer there, or Brisbane, it'd be a developer there. It's just fraught with danger. So yeah, on a more micro level in Melbourne, I think it's a smart thing to sort of specialise in certain areas and suburbs only.
Yeah, I agree that street to street thing, you know, like one street back is not as good as this street here, and that one's got a view, but you don't know that view because you can't see it from the street. And so it can look like a bargain on paper, and that's where that paper analysis becomes really tricky sometimes, when you're kind of looking across a map, maybe in a different area or a different city or location, and you're kind of going, oh, well, that one's $2,500 a square meter and that sold for $10,000 a square meter, so surely I can pick up the difference between those two. And you're like, not always. Yeah.
That's like what makes property so interesting. It's like such an inefficient market compared to, you know, the share market, where it's very liquid and everyone has access to all the information. Property is so nuanced and so many little things that affect it, you know, affect values. So like, I'm quite an analytical person and, you know, I love a spreadsheet more than most. And having done a commerce degree at the start of my career, I spent a lot of time focusing on that. But I think you don't want to get too bogged down in that and trying to sort of compare sites just on sales alone and square meter rates and try to put everything down to a number, because yeah, exactly like you said, street to street, there can be a dramatic difference in value literally just because of a street name, the width of it, the street trees, the presence, then interfaces, north facing versus south facing, but you might be next to a three level block of flats with everyone looking into your backyard, or you might be next to an amazing home with huge setbacks. There's so many nuances in property that affect value. So even we're looking at a house where you went and inspected one a couple of days ago in Brighton Street, Richmond, which on land looks amazing. It's, you know, $2.8 million for 700 square meters. And there's comps in that area that have sold for in excess of $8,000 a square meter as recently as 3 or 4 weeks ago. But there's a reason for it. It's because it's at the end of a driveway, there's no street presence, it's got a block of flats next to it. Whereas the other one that sold was on a corner, a lot more street frontage, northerly aspect, very easy to build two townhouses on it. And it's worth, you know, almost three times on the rate of land in the same street. So that's kind of how crazy it can get, you know, and how much variance there can be in values within one street alone, yet alone a whole suburb.
And so that one you can kind of identify in some ways, but some of those things you can't identify either. There could be overlays, or, you know, like one side of the street might have a heritage overlay and the other side of the street doesn't. And what that can mean for it is like a year or 2 years worth of planning, which adds to the cost of the development as well, and means you won't be able to achieve the same thing as you could achieve on the other side of the street. So buyer beware for sure. But I guess that's where that experience and that learning comes from. And then understanding how to run the numbers, how to kind of then put that emotional and the smarts behind actually seeing it for what it is. Because a lot of the things that you're doing when you're in the property market, I think, is interpreting what you see and then making kind of dollar decisions based on how you feel about something.
Yeah. And I think the more experience you get and the older you get and the more you've been doing it, the more you become confident in your gut feel and just seeing something and being like, this has got to work or it's not. At the start of my career, there's no way I would have gone and bought a site without, you know, running the numbers in details. And we wouldn't do that now, but we can tell pretty quickly if something is just not going to work or it's going to be amazing. And, you know, I've worked with some older guys that are, you know, in their 50s and 60s and 70s, highly successful. And they, you know, they almost just do it on the back of an envelope or in their head. And I never could understand how that worked, but it's just experience. So, you know, at the start, you definitely can't do that. But the more of an expert that you become, and the more time you spend in a certain market, the more that you can sort of make judgment calls about the viability or otherwise of a site.
Better the back of the envelope becomes, because you actually factor in more correct or real numbers rather than the optimistic thinking that sometimes comes from the initial ones when you're starting out.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one of the things that when I've had mates approach me and want to do some development or whatever else is, you know, run through a feasibility, and it's in their heads, there might be 20 line items, but then you go and put in everything and there's 100 line items and they're like, what the hell is a metropolitan planning levy or what's a public open space contribution or building surveyor fees just went up at the end of last year. Like there's so many things that people just simply don't consider that add to cost. And that's kind of that whole thing about being an expert rather than just sort of doing it as a hobby on the side.
There is now a jackhammer in the background, which is amazing. And it's not one on our site, which is great. So enjoy that. The sound of building. Where were we? I've lost it. Oh, yeah, the number of items. Okay, yeah. So, look, we use a spreadsheet and it's not by any means comprehensive, but for smaller projects, it's fine. But it does serve as a checklist. I guess the bigger the project, the bigger the amount of variance that you can get between each of the numbers. And forgetting something like fees or private open space contributions or some of these things can kind of sneak up on you if you don't know what you're doing. So having that kind of knowledge and experience and I guess getting someone who knows what they're doing to help you, super important.
Yeah, you know, they can be pretty huge amounts of dollars, like, you know, public open space contributions, a good example. It's 5% of the site value. Like the site value can move, you know, plus or minus 20% there. So when you're looking at feasibilities and say you're targeting a 10% return on cost, if you've left that out of your feasibility or, you know, you've got the values in that wrong, it's a pretty big hit just straight off the bat. But, you know, there's 20 items in a feasibility that falls into that category.
Now, I guess it's probably good to point out at this point that Angle works with quite high-end but also larger scale projects and developments. So, you know, with all of those things, there's by doing a larger scale development, there's a potential great upside, but also you're mitigating the risk and the downside because if you get the numbers wrong on something that's quite large, that can be more of a problem.
It can go both ways. I think like we've found that our sweet spot for a project's probably in the $30 to $50 million range. And the reason that we kind of like that size is a bit of scale. Your time that takes to deliver that project versus a $10 million project is probably the same, yet the reward's better. But it also, it does smooth out the bumps a little bit. So with your contingencies, we always put a 5% total project cost minus land as our contingency in a FISO. So on a bigger project, your contingency gets larger and you can kind of ride some of those bumps a little bit better, in particular things like authority costs. But you're absolutely right. The bigger the project, the more that's at stake. And if you are out by 10% on your end sales rate, that's 10% of a lot of money. So yeah, there's more risk, there's more money at stake, but the smaller projects, it doesn't take very much to derail them. And you probably need to be even more precise with your assumptions than the larger ones, which have a little bit more wriggle room in them.
Yeah, look, I mean, for what we do, so we like between 3 to 5. That's probably our happy place because there's not as much risk and we can kind of turn them over while managing the families and stuff and we don't need a big team.
Like we'd probably be shocking at doing a $3 to $5 million project. Like,
right, because your overhead would be too high. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, it is a very different model. So I think, you know, people can go fall into the trap both ways, trying to do projects that are too big for them and get out of their depth or, you know, step down into projects that aren't big enough and you're exactly right, your scale just isn't appropriate.
Yeah. What I also find interesting is that if you look over the last couple of years, there's been quite a number of builders that have been caught when they're stepping out of their lane. You know, they might be a great resi builder building kind of a high-end house model and then they've stepped out of their lane, they've done a commercial project or tried to do a tower and they just haven't understood the cost completely. So how would you... Yeah.
Yeah, builders are really, it's a tough one there because the residential guys going into commercial probably don't have the systems and processes in place that the big guys have. Whereas the commercial guys are, you know, tend to be a lot better and more disciplined and it's more sort of robotic in a way, but then stepping back into resi, they might not have the eye for detail and the craftsmanship and quality suffers. So domestic stepping into resi is for us as a developer feels dangerous, in particular on program risk, because I feel like they're probably the ones that are get caught out on time. But then, yeah, equally the bigger guys stepping back down into delivering something that's really high end, they might just not have the eye of detail or the appropriate subcontractors to deliver something of a really high quality spec. So it is difficult, especially I think in that sort of $5 million to $15 million range, I feel like is almost the hardest part because you've got a lot sort of stepping in and out both ways.
Yeah, and it's the competitive nature of it. So I find this as well when we look at projects, it's that bottom end of the market where maybe we're talking about kind of a mum and dad investor in this case, but if we're looking at it like a single fronted terrace house, there's a lot of emotional appeal and your fixer-upper is actually so expensive to get into because people feel like it's an achievable buy-in rate. So you're not going to be making a lot of money and there's actually more risk in doing something like that. Whereas if you can step into a field where there isn't so much competition and really compete to buy the land, purchase in your own lane, and I think that's what you do really well is, you know, you're buying a project. What, how often would you buy?
You know, as a rule of thumb, we just like to buy a project a year and probably have 3 to 4 projects on the books at any one point in time. It never works out like that. Like, we didn't buy a site for 2 years and we bought 2 in 2 weeks, and I think that's actually a pretty important thing. It's a mantra of ours is you can't go into acquisition mode and out of acquisition mode. You just need to be looking all of the time because opportunities pop up when you least expect them. And I think it's very dangerous if you try to force yourself to buy a site and you give yourself, you know, a fixed time period, or you're trying to feed a pipeline. I think you make bad decisions because you feel like you need to do something. Patience is huge. Like, property, it's funny. It just occasionally something just slips through the cracks and somebody doesn't see something that you do, or for whatever, you know, reason there wasn't much competition, or the time of year, or there might be Derby Day races and people are off, you know, getting ready for that, so they didn't go to the auction. There's so many circumstantial things in property. If you're patient then and wait for the right site to pick, it really pays off.
You know, there aren't that many people looking to do exactly what you're looking to do on each site, right? And I find that with what you're doing. So if you just kind of stay along with it, sometimes people are just busy or they're not on the cash cycle, or there's only so many people competing in that market.
Yeah, it's actually quite funny. We're friends with a lot of other developers in the industry, and in other industries people might look at it and go, oh, they're your competitors, why are you friends with them? I can't even think of an auction that we've ever rocked up to, or an EOI campaign where we've actually gone head to head with one of our peers in the industry. You know, I'm sure it's happened before and we haven't known about it, but you're right. It's just different times of the cycle. You see value when somebody else doesn't. You're getting advice from your plan and the other person's getting more conservative or more aggressive advice. There's so many circumstances that mean that, yeah, you aren't competing against the same people or as many people as you might think.
I mean, look, in our kind of work, we tend to speak openly to all of them. So we'll kind of, one of us will back off or someone will claim it first, and then we just kind of run with that, if that makes sense. We kind of have that understanding, or we might not know. And it's like, you know, depending on the style of auction, it's not an issue for us either, because also we're not turning over that volume. So you're looking for, you know, one site a year. There's lots of sites that come up.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, there's enough to go around for everyone. You don't have to be competing and fighting for sites all the time. You know, it goes in cycles. Like, at the moment, it's probably not as competitive as it's been in the past, but it's ramping up. Sometimes it is ultra competitive. But again, I think you just need to be in the market the whole time and just looking the whole time, because you just never know when a good opportunity might arise.
I guess one tip for people who are looking to develop property for themselves.
One tip. Don't try to take on too much in terms of learning lots of markets and looking everywhere. I'd try to keep your search relatively confined. It's too hard to spread yourself thin amongst agents and learning streets and the nuances of certain pockets and values. If you try to go super wide with your search, you'll make mistakes and you'll stuff up assumptions in your feasibility. I think start in a pretty confined area and become an expert in that area, in particular at the start, and then sort of go from there.
Yeah. So thank you for talking to us today. We're going to wrap it up here, but we're going to continue talking to you in our Developers Inner Circle. So what that is it's an exclusive group of women who are developing for profit and really learning from experts. And some of the things that we're going to talk to you about in there are how you pick those emerging designers and how you get those high-end finishes and how you work with people in that area. So if you are looking to develop for profit and you want to get in touch with us, then please DM us on Instagram, send us an email or a message, and we can talk to you about what the process is there. But thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Building with Build Her. We'd love for you to spread the word.
For show notes, links and downloads and other awesome resources and freebies, head to buildhercollective.com.au. And don't forget, that's Build Her with an H-E-R.
And if you enjoyed this episode, it would mean so much to both of us if you could take a minute or two to leave a review.
And don't forget to subscribe so you can listen next time as we talk all things building and women making their mark in the building industry.